Hi everybody, welcome to a new year of AZMcast. For whatever reason, people are letting Jared and I do this again, so we're going to keep going. This is a monthly podcast that we put out for our residents, our nurses, our faculty at the University of Arizona, and anybody else who would care to listen, medical students, pharmacists, people that just happen to be passing by. We hope to get you some high-quality emergency medicine education. We like to do some case reports. We like to look at some of the literature and see what it says about those issues that we run up against. We like to do a little bit of billing and coding, some documentation stuff for you. And we like mostly to have clinical pearls, things that you can understand that will carry you into your next shift. That's what we hope for. This month we've got a discussion with Mark Wright, who's one of our emergency medicine faculty, and he's going to talk to us about dermatology and how we should be thinking about it in order to describe it to other people, in order to figure out what are the life-threatening things versus the non-life-threatening things. We're also going to discuss a case, very interesting case that I had, and Jared and I are going to talk about some of the critical actions you need to take. We're going to have you run through it in your own mind and see if you can figure out what's going to happen with this case. And lastly, we're going to throw in a spot about documentation with Scott Lowry, who's one of our emergency faculty as well. Scott's got a great view on this. He's got a good perspective, so he's really nice to ask about how you do your documentation. And sandwiched in here, we've got a segment called A Million Ways to Die, which is ways that you need to be able to identify and treat so that your patient doesn't die. They're usually strange or interesting cases, and Jared's got a good one this month. So strap in, listen up, and here we go.
When they show you the picture of all the STDs, and you're like, my herpes looks nothing like that.
Good deal.
So Jared and I invited Mark Wright, who is one of our family community medicine trained physicians, who has been around and seen quite a bit of dermatology in his day, to talk about dermatology. What better to do for a podcast than dermatology? But Mark's actually got a great approach to this. So we're going to ask him just to intro real quick of what he's going to be talking about.
Yeah, first off, I want to thank you guys for inviting me. Love your show.
That's the first time that's happened.
It's a great show. It's totally cool. So as you can imagine, dermatology is a pretty big field. And in this kind of format, since there's nothing visual, it's going to be kind of hard to see stuff. But I think most of the time when you've gone to a talk about dermatology, what you end up getting is a series of slides of all these different kind of dermatologic conditions that you may have seen, you may not have seen. And what I want to try to do is give you an approach that's a little more organized. I'm going to do a little bit of general dermatology and also kind of focus on pediatric here at the end too. My background in derm, my interest in derm started when I was in med school, and at the time, the head of the derm department, who's now retired, had a book called The Dermatology for the House Officer. And it was a series of books that had basically specialties and had books in all the major specialties. Pediatrics.
Yeah, I was going to say, I actually had a copy of that book. It's out of print now, and I found it on eBay. And it's exactly what we're trying to do, which is describe rashes without, there's no pictures in it.
That's correct, right. It doesn't have pictures, which, you know, you think, oh, how can you do derm without pictures? So when I was in school, it was actually one of the most popular rotations we did. Everybody wanted to take it. It wasn't just because, hey, it's a pretty easy cake rotation, no call, no weekends, no nights, which is pretty attractive to most med students.
Which it was.
Right. Yeah. But he actually used his book as the outline for the rotation. He didn't force people to buy it, most of us did, but he actually developed, I believe, one of the first algorithms to try to figure out how to how to diagnose a rash when you see one. The book is out of print, but, and I have no financial association with this, but he actually just put out this year, a couple months ago, a iPod, iPad, and iPhone version of it with pictures. So anyway, he's now a retired dermatologist at the, he's a professor emeritus at the University of California, UC Davis. And his approach, when you look at the book and look at the, if you download this app, what his point was that there's about 2,000 or more identified dermatologic rashes. Out of that, he condensed down into the algorithm 75 of the most common ones you see. Now, for me, looking at the algorithm and the names of the diseases that are on the algorithm, there's still a lot of those I probably have not seen, or if I've seen it, I didn't identify it. But I look at that and say, okay, this is a place to start. The app, I've actually gone through the app, and it actually mirrors the book almost exactly. It's not encyclopedic, so it actually is something you can digest. It's something that's at least worthwhile trying it out and looking at it. But I would take it systematically, and actually, if you do look at it, go through it and go through the introduction. And one of the first things that they teach you is that if you can describe a dermatologic lesion with the right terminology, a dermatologist can oftentimes diagnose or get a really close differential over the phone without even seeing it.
The one thing I struggle with, Mark, is when, and I don't work in the PGD very often, but when I see all these rashes, it's either nothing or it's something horrible. And I go back to my computer and look on Google or look in the Atlas of Dermatology, and they always give you the most horrifying version of that disease.
Right, and that's actually been the most common approach, in trying to find something that looks similar. And, you know, and that's understandable. It's just that that's, as you can imagine, very inefficient. And if you look at atlases, most of them have the most dramatic form of the disease. All skin conditions actually have variants, and it's going to be really hard to figure out what it is. First decision tree, sick kid, not sick. So if a kid comes in with a rash and it looks sick, I would be a little more concerned about that particular type of rash. It behooves us all to at least have some kind of an approach. The good news is that there's a lot of really common stuff that comes in over and over and over. And at the end, what I'm going to do is give you my top 10 things that I think we see all the time, over and over and over. But I think that if you look at these 10 specific conditions or groups of conditions, those are the ones we see all the time. And my recommendation would be learn those, learn the variants.
This is very similar to how I talk to parents about the peds rashes. I go, you know, there's so many rashes out there that in emergency medicine, we're taught the dangerous ones, we're taught the common ones, and then there's everything else. But the nice thing is, for the most part, everything else is not dangerous, so you got a little time to figure it out. But this is seriously going to bother you as a parent. Probably not going to bug the kid, but it's really going to bug you as a parent for a long time.
Right. Yeah, and I think that you've probably had that experience too, particularly with pediatrics, that oftentimes the parents are really worried about it, and understandably. And most of them are not sick. And most of them are common skin problems, like I said, that I think you can work through it. And if you learn those common ones, you'll be able to say, hey, this fits that. This is probably that. And if not, then you can go to the algorithm, you use that form, or I'll even tell parents too. There's times when I said, there's skin problems that are common. We see them a lot. I can show you a picture in a book. This is what you have. And then there's ones that are not common that I'm not even going to know. And as long as that person's not super sick, it's really something that I need help with a dermatologist. That's why there's a whole field dedicated to just skin diseases. So, and I think that helps kind of take the pressure off us in the emergency department, basically saying that, hey, you're a doctor, you should know all this stuff. It's like, yeah, we see a lot of common stuff, but there's stuff we don't see very often. And it is something that we have to have our dermatology colleagues help us with.
Well, you guys are better doctors than I, because I usually just tell them, unless your skin's turning black or falling off, you're probably okay.
We are better doctors than that.
There was a dermatologist that came to give us a lecture a couple of years ago, and we may be jumping ahead a little bit, but she used to say, or she told us that if you have a patient with a rash that you don't think is systemically ill, that you think needs to follow up with a dermatologist, don't give them steroids or topical steroids, because then they go to follow up 2 weeks later and the rash is gone and they can never figure out what it was.
Right. Yeah. The problem with that is that parents want something done.
Right.
And even adults, you know, they want you to do something to it. And unfortunately, there are some skin, a lot of skin conditions, when you do stuff to it, it actually aggravates it. Mm-hmm. It actually makes it worse. So, yeah, but steroids are one of the more common tools. I mean, it's like they say in dermatology, you know, if it's wet, dry it. If it's dry, wet it. When you don't know what else to do, use steroids. Mm-hmm. Isn't that right?
Yeah, yeah, I think that's pretty much it. So let's say, so you walk up and you've got, you're on your shift and you got a patient or a nurse or somebody goes, hey, what does this look like to you? And, you know, drops trowel in the middle of the ED and is like, hey, what do you
it
think?
It happens, actually.
Yeah, no, I know. But so how do you approach this rash? Like, what do you do? What do you? How do you evaluate it?
So I think the approach really is to learn the common stuff and the variants and kind of know what they commonly are. Okay. And I'll go through some of those. And then, as I said, after that, you know, have other colleagues come in and look at it. You know, if you're by yourself out in a rural area, you're kind of stuck. But if you have other people around, you know, have some people come in, and like the doc the other day came to me and said, hey, could you come look at this rash? And there's, what you'll see is there's patterns of stuff that keep coming on a regular basis. Like right now, summertime, we're seeing a lot of insect bites. Insect bites has a very characteristic appearance. They're common. Once you start seeing them, you'll start seeing a lot of them. Every day you'll start seeing them. So that kind of pattern you'll kind of get used to. And like, for example, insect bites usually have isolated erythematous papules with a little pointy tenting lesion in the center. They've got a little tiny hard center where basically the punctum was. So if you feel them, you know, so don't be afraid to touch rashes, because it will help too. Touching them, see if they blanch, those things are also important.
So just to break in here for a quick moment, things that I find scary on rashes, non-blanching rashes, petechiae, purpura, those are always scary things. Rashes that show up on the palms or the soles should make you a little more concerned, but not necessarily dangerous. It just makes it stand out a little more. And you should always be concerned for sloughing of the skin, anything that's desquamating, anything that flakes off, anything that has that Niklofsky sign where you push on it and you suddenly get a new bullous lesion. Generally not a good thing. Mark's going to go into now a little bit of the description of rashes. There's nothing worse than having to present a rash to anybody, your attending, your colleague, someone over the phone. You try to get them to describe it. So Mark is going to talk a little bit about the true descriptive nature of rashes so that you can discuss it with a dermatologist, discuss it with your admitting physician, and sound like an intelligent person versus it's kind of rash-like in nature with kind of a rashy, rash tone to it.
Being able to kind of understand the terminology of dermatology is actually important. And although I know the listeners can't see this, there's a list of It's not encyclopedic. It's fairly simple, common terms that dermatologists use to describe lesions. And as I said, if you can describe a lesion over the phone, a good dermatologist can probably tell you what it is without even looking at it, or come pretty close. So they divide it into things like surface changes, comparing to like normal smooth skin to scaly to, you know, changes that have exudate, crusts, excoriations. And then sort of raised lesions that look like warts or papillomatous, that's another term they use. And then there's also the descriptor of the type of lesion, a macule. A macule is a lesion that's a flat lesion that is less than a centimeter, for example. A patch is a flat lesion that is greater than a centimeter. So that's a terminology that dermatologists will use. So when you see someone that has a rash and they have little tiny punctate lesions and you can't feel them, then that's really a macule. And they encourage you to touch them, because if you feel something raised on the skin, even without looking at the rash, if you feel something raised on the skin, then it's actually palpable. If you see a rash, you touch the skin and you don't feel it, then it's flat, then it's a macule. So, and then I'll just list these other things, like nodules. They're big. They're basically a raised lesion that's over a centimeter, a plaque, basically raised lesion over a centimeter where the diameter thickness is greater than the diameter is greater than the thickness. Pustules, most of the senos are basically they're fluid-filled lesions that have a milky fluid. That's as opposed to a vesicle. A vesicle is a fluid-filled lesion that has clear fluid. Erosions, either excoriated erosions where someone's been scratching, or an erosion where the skin's starting to break down, like a case I just saw the other day. I've only seen two cases of this. Saw somebody who probably had a brown spider bite. And a brown spider bite, the classic finding is that you get a central ulcer that starts expanding. So those kind of terms are important to know. And we can try to get, I can even try to put these things on the website.
Once we get one.
So they said in kids, the approach is first, are they sick or are they not sick? Second thing I would recommend people do is learn the common disorders and their variants. Okay, we talked about that. Third thing is that in pediatrics specifically, there are a lot of non-pathologic conditions that you need to know. There are things that newborns are oftentimes born with. Usually you learn these on a pediatric rotation or when you're in the newborn nursery, but you know, you may have done a rotation for 3 weeks there and not seen half those things. Dermatologists say that there are more common diseases with variants than there are uncommon diseases that you're going to see. You're going to see more of the common stuff that just looks different.
Having said that, we wanted Mark to focus a little bit on some of the life-threatening diseases. So we asked him to talk about some of the rashes that present that you can't miss. You have to pick this up the first time or else you may not get a second time.
Meningococcemia. If you got a kid or an adult that has a petechial rash and they look sick, you need to be concerned. I mean, obviously. So I can tell you, I saw this disease the first time as a med student, and I'll never forget it. I was actually at a hospital in Phoenix, and it was an adult who was at a kid's birthday party. He was an anesthesiologist. I remember walking by the ICU and seeing him in isolation, and he looked like a eggplant. Didn't make it, and I'll never forget it. So very impressive disease. If you've ever seen it, it's one of those things you don't want to miss it. And I know that we had a case here a few years back where a university student came in for a sprained ankle. She's in her early 20s. Because the ER was backed up, took her a while to get everything done, to get her x-ray, and she developed a rash while she was here. So that's one you want to know. You want to at least know what it looks like. Petechial rashes basically are purplish, reddish to purplish, small hemorrhages in the skin that don't blanch. So again, that's an infection that if you run into that, you're going to get treated prophylactically after it, but don't be afraid to check the lesion to see if it blanches, because that's one of the more important diagnostic hallmarks of it.
I had one as a third year resident that went to her doctor. She was a 6-year-old. Went to her doctor the day before for a petechial rash. Doctor said, oh, you're fine. Next day, full on purpura, disseminated meningococcus, and died. So how do you determine whether a petechial rash is concerning or not? What if they don't look sick and have a petechial rash?
I just had a case like this. I literally just had a case a week ago. I had an adult, not a kid, came with a petechial rash on her lower extremities. She had a connective tissue disorder. I wasn't sure, but I can tell you, my suspicion was up, and I did a lab workup on her to make sure that her white count was normal, her platelets were normal. She didn't have any new drugs. There's a number of things, and she didn't feel sick. She hadn't been traveling. I kind of went through. I always, when people come with rashes, one of the things I learned was that I always ask people if they've been traveling outside the country. Have they been camping? Have they been, they've been drinking out of any streams, anything like that. Something unusual that, and I get in the habit of doing that when people come in ill with a sickness, a flu-like illness. Have you traveled anywhere?
Yeah.
So in her case, I did a lab workup. All her labs were totally normal. She was asymptomatic. She was appropriate. She stayed there for a couple hours because I wanted to see if this rash evolved. Didn't do anything at all. And I will say, I sent her home with a plan to come back. She came back the next day. The rash was already fading. My suspicion is that this was probably some sort of vasculitis that had something to do with her connective tissue disorder. But again, my first thought was, does she have early meningococcus? Mm-hmm. So we want to think about it. I don't know. What are your thoughts on?
I agree. I freak out when I see petechial rashes.
And I think you should. I think one of the things that Mark notes is you touch the rash. And if you come in and say, yeah, they've got a rash, whatever, I go, okay, does it blanch? And I get kind of sometimes I get blank stares, and then, yes. So blanching, just so that it's clear, is when you push on it and it goes white because you push all the blood out of the capillaries and then it quickly comes back. That's a vascular phenomenon. And so that usually indicates there's something vascular going on to a degree. It's inflammatory or something like that.
Yeah.
But a petechial rash, when you push on it, it's not going to blanch. It's not going to change colors because, as Mark said, it's bleeding into the skin. So anybody with a petechial or a purpuric rash, in my book, is at the very least going to get a few hours of observation, if not some laboratory work, to make sure that it's not one of the other dangerous things you're going to talk
right.
about.
And there are some other platelet stores like ITP and TTP that actually have some disorders that are platelets that actually can present like this too. And again, I'm kind of going back and forth between adults and peds because you're going to see these in adults as well.
You know what we see a lot of, what we don't even realize it, is Rocky Mountain spotted fever. We've had several patients in the ICU that end up coming back positive for Rocky Mountain spotted
really?
Fever. Yeah.
Okay, because that was actually one of the other ones on the list of the emerging conditions. And, you know, look for that in an atlas, look for various, you know, sometimes they start out really early. And that's actually going to be a petechial-like rash as well.
Mm-hmm.
So again, petechial rash, be concerned. Keep people around. As I said, that case where we had a gal that actually hurt her ankle, she developed it right there in front of us. So rickettsial diseases, or Rocky Mountain spotted fever is another one. I don't know how common it is here. I don't know if your experience with it. Obviously,
I know we saw it several times this year. I don't know if I could give you epidemiology statistics.
Well, I can tell you it's endemic, at least in the Tucson area. It's endemic to the White Mountains. So if you have somebody that has recently been to the Apache Reservation and the White Mountains, that's a concern. That's a known endemic place. It's carried by the prairie dogs around there, or the ticks on the prairie dogs. And the thing to remember about it is that it starts on the extremities and moves inward.
Yeah, and that's actually contrary to most of the other viral exanthems that kids get. Most of the viral exanthems start central and move outward. So things like the kind of the common, we can talk about that too, the common sort of viral exanthem that kids get to come in, you know, mild flu or cold recently or currently, they've got this fine sort of macular, you know, small punctate macular rash, usually on their trunk and part of their proximal extremities. But there are some rashes that worry about that start acral, they call it in the mm-hmm. derm world, on their hands or basically on their head, on your extremities, basically your hands, feet, and your face.
So Mark goes on to talk a little more about some of the common rashes that we'll see, especially during the summertime, and some of the normal newborn rashes, but we're going to save that for next month to kind of highlight some of the big things that he was talking about with rashes. We're in the emergency department for a reason. We want to find the sick stuff. So sick versus not sick. If they're sick, you look for everything and you watch that rash because it will grow and expand and do funny things in front of your eyes. If they're not yet sick, but they've got some concerning findings like purpura, sloughing of the skin, or involvement of the mucous membranes, you need to keep an eye on them. A little bit of observation goes a long way. Watching them in the emergency department, seeing if they can tolerate liquids, seeing if they develop a fever or have any of these other scary things is highly, highly valuable. So thanks to Mark, we're going to talk to him a little bit more next time about some of the more simple stuff, because even though we like to see most of the dangerous stuff and get in there, most of the rashes that we see in the emergency department are not going to be life-threatening.
How's the life-saving business?
It's fine.
It must take a really, really big zit to kill a man.
He's with you.
You call yourself lifesaver. I call you pimple popper, MD.
So Jared and I talked a little bit about how we can make the format a little more pleasing. We talked to some people. People like cases. Cases are always fun. People like the basic science stuff and the approach, and people like the really cool stuff with the new evidence and the hottest things going. We don't have any of that. But we do have a really interesting case that I had a couple weeks ago that some of you have probably already heard about. There's a lot of good learning points from this. There's a little bit of evidence that you can apply in order to make your decision. There's a little bit of physiology you have to think about. And there are some basic first steps approach that I think would be a good starter case for our July episode.
All right, Jared, I got a case for you.
Let's hear it.
So this is an 89-year-old guy who's coming in by EMS. And what you get on the EMS little telly that you get on your text message is heart rate 179, blood pressure 63/40, questionable mentation. So you're getting all of your stuff together. What's going through your mind as far as your initial approach to this patient?
Well, three things really. One, the patient's in shock. There's signs of end organ dysfunction with the altered mental status, right? The second is that the heart rate is way too fast for, would you say, 89-year-old?
Yeah.
Way too fast for an 89-year-old. He's clearly not going to maintain his cardiac output. So in terms of...
That's too fast for an 8 and a 9-year-old if you combine their heart rates.
Exactly. So in terms of approaching the undifferentiated hypotension patient, the first question you have to ask is this a cardiac output problem or is this a SVR problem? If it's an SVR problem, you know that you have some kind of systemic dilatory response going on. So you're going to have a wide pulse pressure, floppy blood vessels, and those symptoms or those syndromes are usually sepsis, anaphylaxis, those kinds of things. If you have a cardiac output problem, usually you have a narrow pulse pressure. Your guy has a narrow pulse pressure. He's 63 over 40. So when you have a cardiac output problem, the reason for your undifferentiated hypotension is a heart problem. You have low cardiac output. In his case, it's likely from the tachycardia.
So the guy gets here and EMS says, hey, here's our EKG. And it shows a very fast, narrow complex tachycardia. And he goes, and by the way, we, per our protocol, pushed some adenosine on the guy and he just came right back into it. And when you look at the rhythm strip where they pushed adenosine, you see flutter waves. So now you see a guy who, thankfully, because of EMS, have uncovered his primary dysrhythmia. So he's got atrial flutter with a rapid ventricular response. Great, we got an answer. So now you've got this elderly gentleman who is looking at you, and you actually look, his ears were purple, like with poor cap refill, like his extremities were kind of cool. I mean, he was clinically, vital signs, everything looked like shock. So now you've got a guy with a primary dysrhythmia and hypotension. So now how do you approach this guy?
Well, I would say you have somebody who's in shock from an egregious heart rate, from a dysrhythmia, and that is an indication to cardiovert somebody. If you're scared to cardiovert them because maybe they have chronic AFib, they're 89 years old, you don't want to give them a stroke, it's reasonable to say that you can slow them down and see if they spontaneously convert out of A-flutter, but A-flutter is a little different than AFib. But I think it's also reasonable to say I'm going to slow them down to something more appropriate for their age and see if their shock improves until you can come up with a better history in terms of are they chronically in AFib, do they take Coumadin, is there INR therapeutic, so on and so forth.
So the pathophys of this is that your cardiac output's going to be determined by your stroke volume and your heart rate, but once you get to a point, your heart rate is so fast that it doesn't allow you to fill. And that's kind of what I'm trying to figure out with this guy. Is he hypotensive because he's septic or something else, or is this just because he's beating so fast he's not giving his heart time to fill and he's having pump failure?
Yeah, well, I mean, you get pump failure from two reasons. One is you beat so fast that you don't have diastolic filling, and so you can't eject a stroke volume, so your blood vessels clamp up to try to maintain forward flow. The second is because you don't have diastolic filling, you don't have enough time, or because you have a short diastolic time, you don't have enough time to perfuse your coronaries, you get coronary ischemia and heart failure from that.
Okay. So we took a look at this guy, we were debating on what to do. So the question that I had after the fact was, if I'm going to decide to slow this guy down, what am I going to use to slow him down? What do you normally use to slow down your patients with AFib or A-flutter with a rapid ventricular response?
Normal blood pressure,
we'll say.
I like DILT.
I like DILT as well. Now, why do I like DILT? It's because I'm pretty sure Jared was my attending and said, hey, we're going to use DILT. And I said, great, sounds awesome. But since I'm a year older now and I can't trust Jared for everything, we went on a evidence-based search and we found from the, this is in GEM of 2005. So this is comparison of the effectiveness of intravenous diltiazem and metoprolol in the management of rapid ventricular rate. This is in AFib. So AFib, even more notoriously difficult to control than A-flutter. So if you can control it in AFib, my hope was that you could control A-flutter just as well. So What they did is they randomized these patients to either receiving IV diltiazem or IV metoprolol, and they checked their blood pressures and their heart rate at 2, 5, 10, 15, and 20 minutes. And if they didn't get a response by that point, if they couldn't get the heart rate below 100, then or at least decrease their ventricular rate by 20%, that was considered a failure. So what happened? They put everybody through it. Both of them were safe and effective. So bad outcomes, no bad outcomes, because all of these patients already had a normal blood pressure. However, the effect began earlier, and the decrease in the heart rate was more if you used diltiazem. So that's why I've used diltiazem now. Used to be because that's what my attending told me to do. So diltiazem has a little bit of a quicker efficacy and more potent efficacy based on this study.
Yeah, and I don't really like metoprolol because it's, you know, there's peripheral beta receptors, and yeah, there's peripheral calcium channel receptors, but it's DILT is really designed to hit the AV node. So, you know, with metoprolol, I just feel like you might get more systemic hypotension. You have the potential to get more hypotension. So for that reason, and it's a little bit longer acting. So for that reason, if I have somebody that I really want to slow down, I like Esmolol.
Okay.
I don't think there's any data to support that. This is just strictly my opinion, but Esmolol, if I'm going to use a beta blocker.
So the data says DILT if you have a patient that's normotensive, but our patient's hypotensive. So I'm worried, well, are they having the dysrhythmia because they're hypotensive, or are they hypotensive because they're having the dysrhythmia? Yeah. So what I did is I grabbed my Zonari and I go take a look at the patient's heart to see, are they hyperdynamic? How are they filling? I wanted an idea of what was going on. And ultrasonographers throughout the city rejoiced because what did I find? Pericardial effusion with tamponade.
How did you know that he had tamponade?
I had no freaking clue. So
well, you have one clue.
Thankfully, he was hypotensive.
He had narrow pulse pressure.
Yeah. The other thing is I called Rich Amini, who happened to be doing RME, and said, hi, I need you here now. It's a quarter after one. I'm all alone and I need you now. Said I wouldn't call, but I lost all control and I need you now. And he came running and put the probe on. And what we saw is a very good-sized effusion, and in a patient that's hypotensive and has poor peripheral perfusion. So Rich did a few more calculations. He got some great views. The patient had complete right ventricular collapse with every beat during diastole. He had really all the earmarks of having pericardial tamponade. So Sophie Galson and I had this patient, and we were discussing back and forth, does the patient have cardiogenic shock, or does he have obstructive shock? So I'm gonna let everybody that's listening just kind of think about that for a while, because your options are very different and neither one of them are all that great. So what do I do? Do I shock this guy and hope that it was his heart rate, or do I stick a needle in his heart and try to drain the fluid? And all the interns and juniors are like, stick a needle in, because you all wanna do it. And those of you that are seniors and attendings are probably like, do we have a little more time to figure this out? So, Jared, what are you going to do?
That's a tough question. So, you know, I don't like to think about things in terms of type of shock, cardiogenic, septic. It's shock is shock. So, we know that you have a patient who's in shock from a heart problem. We originally thought that it was just because of a too fast of a heart rate. So now he also has a narrow pulse pressure. It could be from too fast of a heart rate. But you also have an obstructive process going on, because now the heart can't fill, not only because the heart rate's too high, but also because it has tamponade. It's constricted by the pericardium and the effusion. So, and he's hypotensive. I would say you don't have any reason for him to have a pericardial effusion. You don't have a dissection.
So we start asking the guy, and he's very pleasantly demented and is very pleasantly belligerent as well when we start to tell him some of this stuff. And so we can't get a great history. We try to call his medical power of attorney. Can't get a number. We look at his med list, and it's stuff like Metamucil and Benadryl. I mean, really, can't seem to find anything on this guy.
So I guess here's what I would do. I would be prepared to do both.
Excellent.
And I would start with the one that's easier to do, which would be rate control. So I would drag your ultrasound in there, drag your cardiocentesis kit in there, and someone that knows how to do it. And
we didn't have any of those.
And I would even maybe go so far as to put a little betadine on the chest or something, just in case you had to do it quickly. And in terms of rate control, I would use DILT or amiodarone. The problem with amiodarone is that you can get hypotension with it. And you can get significant hypotension with it, and you're committed to it because the half-life is so long. But thank God we have pressors. The issue with pressors in him, you know, you run into this a lot where you have somebody with AFib with RVR, and you think, well, if I slow them down, their blood pressure will come up. But what if it doesn't? So I might give them phenylephrine. Well, his blood pressure was 60 over 40, so phenylephrine might not do that good of a job. But if you give him something like epinephrine or whatever, then you're going to make his heart rate faster. So I would still use maybe phenylephrine and say, I'm going to slow him down, and hopefully as his diastolic filling improves, then his blood pressure should come up. He has an obstructive process with the fusion, so it's very possible that you slow him down and now the tamponade just gets worse and he still doesn't fill, in which case you would do the pericardiocentesis and you're prepared for it. So that's what I would do. I would do DILT, have some phenylephrine there, and a needle in my hand ready to do the pericardiocentesis if I needed to.
So we got everything prepared. We called cardiology. I have never seen so many cardiologists in my life. It looked like a BMW dealership in that trauma 7. They were just everywhere. So we had all of our stuff ready. We had airway together.
What?
We had
pharmacy. Let me interrupt for a second. Why not cardiovert him?
I'm getting at that.
So we got all of our stuff together and we prepared, just like you said. Pericardiocentesis tray is there. Pacer pads are on the chest. Chest is shaved and ready to go. Patient is getting fluids. All shock will initially respond to fluids. Cardiogenic, eventually you'll push him over the edge. But since he had tamponade, we try to increase his preload. So mm-hmm. we gave him some more fluids. We had everything set. And then we started to think about what are we going to do. So let's say I decide to do the pericardiocentesis. Is this guy going to sit still while I stick a needle in his heart? No, I'm going to have to sedate him. I don't really want to sedate this guy, especially for as long as it's going to take me to muster up the courage to put a needle in this guy's heart. The other concern that the cardiology attending had when he came down...
Tickle in the myocardium.
So the cardiology attending, when he came down, was worried that if you stick a needle in the heart, first of all, do you have enough effusion that you can do it safely? And second, if you don't, are you going to tickle the right ventricle and send this dysrhythmia into something that is truly malignant and a shockable rhythm such as VT or VF that's not perfusing anymore? And then you're really in trouble. So those are my thoughts there. On the other hand, we thought slowing him down, shocking him, what if we shock him into a rhythm that is malignant once again? Or what if we shock him into sinus? So if he shocks into sinus and out of this dysrhythmia, maybe this dysrhythmia was actually keeping him alive with the tamponade.
You're going to sedate him to shock him?
So ultimately, here's what we did. You guys decide on your own. I'm going to give you just a couple seconds. Think about this case. Figure out what you would do on your own. We'll play some elevator music for you. Ultimately, what we did is we had everything ready to go, and we gave him a whiff of Versed, very like we held the bottle under his nose, and shocked him. And what happened is we shocked him, and he converted out of the A flutter. He went to a sinus rhythm of about 80, 85, 98, 103, 113, and then he stayed at 113. So your sinus node is smart. And as soon as your sinus node picked itself up off the floor from the biphasic cardioversion at 200 joules, it said, all right, let's go back to, why am I having to beat so hard? What is going, oh, I'm in tamponade, okay. And so the sinus node picked it up and was able to compensate. And then he went to the OR, got a pericardial window, ended up being from a malignancy.
Did the tamponade physiology go away after it converted to sinus rhythm?
Did not.
So, very nice. Excellent case.
Very interesting case. Lots of cool stuff to talk about. Sophie, we're going to be writing this up as a case report, just so you know. You're going to be writing this up as a case report. I'm going to sign my name. And but an interesting case that brings up lots of questions. First, your approach to hypotension, tachycardia, be prepared to shock for a dysrhythmia. And then consider the other options. Is this septic shock or some other form of shock that's causing your tachycardia? And then I gotta hand it to you, Sreekar, ultrasounds are very useful, fine. In this end, it wouldn't have changed my management, but boy, am I glad I knew that ahead of time so that I could make an intelligent decision. And consider your physiology. Consider what is going to happen physiologically. The evidence that we had up there was great for your normal, run-of-the-mill atrial flutter, AFib with RVR. The evidence tends to support diltiazem, and that's still my go-to. However, in a patient that's hypotensive, that something's just not right, you may have to think outside of the box. My lit review of pericardial tamponade plus dysrhythmia came up with a big goose egg. So
yeah, and just to be sure, just to clarify, the literature that we brought up was for the best drug to rate control. We're not talking about rate control versus rhythm control. We're not talking about rate control versus rhythm control in CHF patients. That's a totally different discussion. Mm-hmm.
And the most important thing for AFib, at least in the ED, is rate control. We want to keep them rate controlled if they have AFib or aflutter, because we don't want them ending up in this situation from their dysrhythmia, that they're increasing their myocardial oxygen demand and giving themselves an MI. So we need to quickly start to act on rate control. It's DILT is not always the first choice. Sometimes the best choice is to find the underlying cause, such as infection or dehydration, give them a bolus, and start to treat the underlying cause plus some kind of a rate control agent.
So I have a case for you for 1,000 ways to die.
Mm-hmm. It's a million now, because the sound bite's cooler.
A million ways to die.
South so fast.
Patient comes in the other day. I see her, and she's like in her 30s, and it's her fourth pregnancy. She's 35 weeks pregnant, and
I'm already terrified.
Yeah, so she comes in with a headache. Her chief complaint is headache for 4 days. So what do you want to know?
Any problems with the pregnancy so far?
Nope. Prenatal care, every scheduled visit, no problems with previous pregnancies.
Does she have any problems with blood clots in the past?
No blood clots, no preeclampsia. She's had her urine checked. Sure. There's no proteinuria, no pretibial edema, no vision changes.
Okay. Is it time for me to sign out yet?
Not quite yet.
All right.
So I go to see her with the resident, actually, because my interest was peaked. It didn't make any sense. And so her blood pressure is normal. It was like 105 or something systolic, which is normal for a pregnancy that far along. And I'm in there talking to her and her family, and she just seems a little drowsy. And you know how patients come in with migraines or whatever, they just want to keep their eyes closed and not really talk to you. That's kind of how she acted. And I asked her mom, I said, is she like this? Her mom says, for the last 4 days, she's just been kind of down like this. So we scanned her head, and she had a huge subdural hematoma.
Jeez.
Spontaneous.
Spontaneous subdural hematoma?
Yeah.
I saw that case.
I looked this up. I did a PubMed search, and there's only one case report in France of somebody who had a spontaneous rupture of a anterior cerebral artery aneurysm that showed up with a spontaneous subdural that far along in pregnancy, but I can't find anything else. And she actually had herniation on her CT, so we had to get her hypertonic saline and transfer her emergently over for neurosurgery and OB to do their thing.
Wow.
Oh my gosh.
So is there a learning point?
I don't even know what the learning point is. That's why it's in the million ways to die.
All right. So what you're suggesting is that we should CT scan every pregnant woman with a headache.
I am not suggesting that. I'm suggesting that if something I've been watching a lot of Dexter lately, so if something tickles your lizard brain is the term he uses, to go with it and work it up.
Oh my gosh. All right. Great. So spontaneous subdural hematomas is now something I need to worry about.
In late pregnancy.
Yeah. Gosh. This job is terrifying sometimes.
So after I pulled myself out of the fetal position, Jared and I actually had a nice discussion on this. I did the PubMed search as well. I can find some evidence that subdural hematomas will happen associated with things that you would expect. If you just had an epidural, having a subdural hematoma, especially a spinal subdural hematoma, seems like something that would make sense. If you have preeclampsia, HELLP syndrome, something that is going to predispose you to increased intracranial pressure or easy bleeding, subdural hematoma makes sense. Whatever happened to Jared's patient just makes me nervous.
Anything that you can kind of take away from this case that will help you in the future, if you're evaluating a pregnant woman with a headache, I think the couple things that I was asking about is coagulopathy. Pregnant women tend to be more coagulopathic, so you have to be concerned about maybe a...
venous thrombosis.
Yeah, transverse sinus thrombosis.
Well, that's kind of the working diagnosis, is that maybe she had a small dural vein thrombosis that then bled, and that's how she got the subdural. We don't really know. Her imaging's not entirely back yet.
Other things you think of, preeclampsia. Once you start getting headaches, you worry that they're going to seize on you and become eclamptic. If you throw in some right upper quadrant pain as well, you want to make sure you check their LFTs and check their platelets to make sure they don't have HELLP syndrome. Maybe that's a reason they're bleeding into their brain.
Say acute stroke, you know, maybe they have a PFO or something with all the circulatory changes that happen in late pregnancy.
So these are real considerations. And if the woman is sitting there texting and otherwise looks fine, maybe some conservative treatment is warranted. However, I think the important thing that you said is that you asked the family, is this normal? No, this isn't normal. If something's out of the ordinary, your exam didn't sound like it was very good, not just a migraine, but a patient that was very, very drowsy and almost tough to arouse, would you say?
Yeah, I asked her to open her eyes, and I had to almost open her eyes for her to shine the light in them because she was... a little out of it.
So you have to take those seriously. And, you know, whether or not, well, maybe an MRI, maybe something else, if she would have waited for an MR, who knows what could have happened.
She had herniation on the CT.
So you have to really trust your exam. You have to really trust when things aren't looking right and consider these things. Because I can almost guarantee you, every time I've tried to order a scan on a pregnant woman, they want me to sign a procedure consent that says that I've convinced them that this is what they need to do. You can shield pregnant women if you need to irradiate them. You can explain to them the risks. There's actually a website, again, no financial interest, but it's radiologyinfo.org, and they'll tell you how many millirads of radiation each of these studies are. And a head CT, you can get, I think, up to 200 head CTs in pregnancy before you reach the 5 millisieverts of dangerous radiation that they've extrapolated from the Hiroshima data. Mm-hmm. And it's not until you have 15 that you actually approach the truly like known teratogen toxicity. So if you need imaging, you need imaging, but trust your judgment. The other thing I would say is, what did you give her for her herniation?
Hypertonic saline.
What's the pregnancy class of 3% saline?
I have no idea.
Doesn't matter,
and
right?
We gave 5%.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Like, if mom dies, baby dies.
Yeah.
So it's important that, you know, if she needs something that is going to save her life, then baby needs that as well. Now, at 35 weeks, maybe... you know, you go for an emergent delivery and then do this all simultaneously. But especially beforehand, like before 20 weeks, give mom what she needs. Give her adenosine. Give her epi. Give her whatever she needs to help her so that she can help take care of baby.
Yeah, agreed. It was
scary case, man.
Uh-huh, 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 uh-huh. Yeah. yeah, yeah. In the Ferrari or Jaguar, switching four lanes, top down, screaming out, money ain't a thing.
Bubble hard in the double law, flashing the rings with the window crack, holla back, money ain't a thing. Jigga, I don't like it if
it's over. Now to something that's equally terrifying, but for a different reason. We're going to talk about billing and coding. Those of you that are seniors, this is going to be something that is readily important to you, especially if you start moonlighting or if you start looking for jobs. You're going to want to ask some of these questions of how your billing system works. If you are a junior, you're going to just see the giant chart stack in front of you and wonder, how am I going to get through these all? If you're an intern, you're wondering, what is this stuff even to begin with? So we do a little segment every month on documentation and billing. We talk about some efficiency issues. We talk about some of the billing issues so that you can get paid for what you do. We also talk about some of the medical legal issues. Your chart is always four things. It is a historical document of what happened during the patient's visit. It's a legal document. It's a billing document, and it's a communication between providers. Getting good at making one document to be all four of those things takes some time. That's why it's a long residency. So we hope that by doing some of these segments every month, we can help you to become a better charter, which is not the biggest part, but is still part of becoming a better doctor.
Today. It doesn't always seem to be that big of a deal when you're just trying to start out. I remember as an intern, I just hoped I didn't kill anybody for a while. But this starts to be a bigger deal as you go on, because eventually you are going to have real jobs where your real bosses are going to want you to focus on this stuff. So don't be upset when one of your attendings emails you because in your review of systems you only had 9 and you forgot to ask the patient if they had nosebleeds or if they peed a lot. So we have Scott Lowry, who's one of our attendings here. Scott has worked in the community. He works here for us now. We're very grateful to have him here. And he's very savvy on this kind of stuff. So I was just going to ask him to break down what are the important parts of the chart from a billing perspective.
So everybody has the sheet or has seen the sheet that has how many review systems, how many points in the HPI, physical exam systems have to be hit to get, say, a level 5 billing. So we're not going to go over what's on that chart. That should be something it's easy to look up and something you should already have. The question more is, what are you looking for? Why do we care? What's the big deal about having 9 versus 10 review systems? So the difference in a level 5 billing, you have to have all the different requirements or they'll downcode you. So let's say you had a patient who you think is a level 5 billing type code patient, and you don't have that 10th review system, your coders are going to downgrade your billing to a level 4 billing. So what the heck does that mean? The charge difference is pretty impressive. From a level 1 to a level 5 is dramatic, and it's more like a logarithmic step. So instead of being $50 more for each code, it's $50 difference from step 1 to step 2, $100 step 2 to step 3, $200 step 3 to step 4, etc. You're talking $200 to $300 versus $150 when you're talking a 4 versus 5. So what is a 4? What is a 5? What do these mean clinically? A level 5 bill is any patient that's admitted can be a level 5 billed code. Remember that the billing code is different and almost exact opposite of the triage code. So level 5 billing is the top line, and level 5 triage is a splinter. So they're going to be opposites.
That's a good way to remember that.
A level 1 should never be in the emergency department. You'll never bill level 1 in the emergency. Even a splinter in the emergency is a level 2 minimum. Suture removal is a level 2 frequently, because you checked the wound, you looked at other things, you didn't just close your eyes and snip the sutures out. So always do more than your minimum requirement. When I was in private practice, my personal practice was to do a level 5 chart for every patient, so I was never downcoded. What does that mean? It means I listened to the heart and lungs and pushed on the belly of every patient, even if I was doing a suture removal. If something came up that ended up complicating it, I was already done and ready for that, and I didn't miss it because I checked for everything. How about review systems? Do I really ask everybody 10 review systems every time? I do. I say any nausea, vomiting, constipation, diarrhea, pain or burning when you pee, numbness, stinging. Yeah, I go through it quickly when I know they're negative or I expect them to be negative. If they stop me or if I'm expecting something to be positive, then I break it up. Any nausea or vomiting, any constipation or diarrhea, I'll be slower and more deliberate. If I'm just taking someone's stitches out, I throw that at them while I'm taking the stitches out. And it's just a rote memorization that I have, my little spiel that I throw out at every patient. Then I can use my macro on Epic and not get in trouble that I used a macro for questions I didn't ask. If you're hitting a macro that has your full 10 or fewer systems and you didn't ask if they pee too much or if they're getting nosebleeds as kids, then it's medical fraud, and that can be, they can go back and edit your charts, they can audit your charts, and it's $100,000 fine for every chart they find that they think is fraud. So it's a big deal.
So we said that we were just going to focus on the billing component, but I wanted to break in because Scott makes a very important legal point here. Don't chart things you didn't do. If you didn't do it, take the cut. Even if that extra $50 or whatever sounds good, don't chart stuff you didn't do. It's just not worth it. If you have time, you can go back and ask the patients the other things to fill in the rest of your 10 review of systems. But if you don't want people going through all of your charts to see if you've made any errors, even ones that were incidental and not on purpose,
so
because then you're going to get
penalized
for all
of this.
Longer than
I have, and he's a lot more streamlined. But me, for efficiency's sake, I knew, like he said, that any patient that gets admitted is a level 5, so don't waste your time. Do the full review of systems, because otherwise, if you don't do the full 10 review of systems and 8 physical exam findings and 4 history and physical findings, then you're really doing work that you're not getting paid for. And I can't think of many other jobs where if you did the work, someone would say, well, you know, I don't like the way this grout looks, so I'm just not going to pay you for the counter that you put in or the tile that you put in. So we just want to make sure that you're getting paid for the stuff that you're doing. So what I would do is I would say, okay, you're an ankle sprain. You know, you're probably not going to be a level 5, so I know that 2 review of systems is plenty. And I wouldn't ask the full 10 on an ankle sprain. That's probably going to be a 2 or a 3 maybe. So you don't need to do as many. So I have my standard full 10 review of systems that I ask every adult patient, and a different one that I ask for every child, especially the nonverbal ones that can't tell you they have chest pain or vision trouble. And then I have my low risk ones, my low acuity ones, that I just ask the important medical ones. Hey, have you had headache, chest pain, trouble breathing, abdominal pain, vomiting? Nope, everything else has been okay. And that's pretty much it, because that's what I want to know to be able to take care of the patient. Personally, I'm not as concerned about the billing being higher or lower. But once you start to be a rock star at this like Scott, you can actually push through them and figure out what's going to work best for your efficiency. All right. So, Scott, if you could give me a couple examples of what would be a level 1, level 2, level 3, and level 4.
Be a well child check at your primary care physician.
Okay, so there's a level 1. What about a level 2?
Level 2 would be your suture removal, a splinter, non-complicated. Someone came in for a contusion because they stubbed their toe.
Okay. Level 3?
Level 3s get a little more creative, more complicated. So level 3 is going to be, yeah, a lot of the kids that come into the PEDS are going to be level 3s. So you're going to have colds, runny nose, more than one symptom. Conjunctivitis even would be a level 3.
So that would be something that Kelly Kellen, our billing and coding head, has told me, is that if you have a focused complaint, just one system, I have a bug bite here, that's probably more of a level 2. It's very, very focused. But if it's a couple systems, it's, no, I've had cough and runny nose and I feel fatigued and I've had fever, that's a little more complicated. What about a level 4?
Level 4s are going to be multiple system or have some comorbidities. So abdominal pain with nausea, vomiting, but it's normally a healthy person. You start to do a workup, you do blood, IV, give them some fluids, that's a level 4. If they're diabetic or if they're old, then you can automatically put that up to a level 5 just from the complications.
And you have to justify that. So going through, the level 5 is going to be everything else. It's going to be the abdominal pain that goes home, even. It's going to be somebody that's got a very complicated medical history that you had to sort through their records and try to figure out what was going on.
Chest pains, fractures.
From there, you've got the different components of what you need to hit. So your history of present illness is one of the ones that, surprisingly, we don't get dinged off of that much.
Outside people do.
Yeah.
So we had partners who would get dinged on their HPI because they'd kind of blow through it. And they'd say, present with abdominal pain. They wouldn't say where, when it started, how bad it was. And they would get dinged on that.
So it's real easy because all you need is four. You need four things about the pain. So if I say that the pain has, the patient has qualifier, severe, location, epigastric, abdominal pain that started 2 days ago, there's a timing, after the patient ingested a jar of habanero peppers. There's a context. There's your four. So if I always ask patients, because it's good medically too, how bad's your pain? Oh, it's real bad. Okay, patient says pain is real bad. That's a qualifier. What were you doing when this pain started? I was playing Nintendo Wii. Patient was playing Nintendo Wii when their pain started. And where's your pain at? They point to it. It's really not that difficult to get those in. You just have to practice it. So some people may be wondering, why are we focusing on billing and coding in July? It's because perfect practice makes perfect. If you practice bad habits, it's going to be hard to get away from them. So start practicing good habits now so that you don't you can make minor adjustments to it, but you don't have to completely rework the way you do things. So along with your HPI, you want to make sure that you have your past medical, social, family history, and you only need two components of that. So if you ask their past medical history and you ask them whether or not they smoke, that's pretty good. From there, you ask all the stuff that's relevant. Your review of systems, you want to make sure that you hit at least 10 to get those level fives. And like I said before, I have the same review of systems I ask every time. In real life, emergency medicine is all about the HPI. Your review of systems really doesn't matter as much. Anything important, relevant in your review of system should actually be in your HPI. So for that reason, this is more of a billing, just a completeness sake thing. So I ask the same questions every time, and I have different ones for kids than I have for adults. For your physical exam, you have to choose 8 physical exam findings. Again, I do the same 8 high-yield physical exam findings on every patient, and then I tailor it differently depending on what the complaint is, and I just know to add those in later. But what about your medical decision-making, Scott? What do you do in your medical decision-making to make sure that you justify the work that you've done?
So I always start with a really quick synopsis of why they're here. The beginning of my medical decision-making sounds a lot like my HPI, kind of abbreviated version. So I would say a 23-year-old female presented with abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting. We placed an IV, gave 1 liter normal saline IV fluid bolus. We'll get back to why the word bolus was important. Gave IV morphine, Zofran for nausea and pain. Patient's laboratory work was all within normal limits. Abdominal x-rays showed no constipation was normal. And patient was discharged with instructions for return precautions, and I go through briefly what the return precautions are in my note as well.
We'll talk more about the legal documentation later, but I'm a big fan of return precautions. We could spend an entire podcast on that, but we won't because that's boring. Instead, I'll trap you in a corner, and we'll talk about return precautions until you make sure you get it done. Dale Woolridge is making faces at us right now through the glass. That's why he's not allowed on the podcast anymore. I was always taught that in your medical decision-making, what you're talking about is you're trying to frame a picture of the patient so that anyone could read that one-liner and understand what was going on. Then you talk about what you did to the patient. We put in an IV, we put them on a monitor, we drew blood, we cathed them, we put in a central line, we intubated them, we did a thoracotomy. We did these things to the patient. And then what did you do for the patient? We gave them a bolus of IV fluids. We gave them IV antiemetics, IV pain control, IV antibiotics, things we did to them. And then lastly, what we did with the patient. We determined that this patient was high risk for acute coronary syndrome. Therefore, we admitted the patient to the medical service. We determined that this patient's abdominal pain was low risk for appendicitis or other surgical pathologies. So we discharged them home with 24-hour follow-up and return precautions.
Yeah, this is a spot you want to talk about why you did stuff and why you didn't do things. So you can even say, if we did not get a D-dimer for Sue, the PE, for further despite having a non-specific S1Q3T3 because the patient was PERC negative. So that's more of your medical decision making of why you did or did not follow something on your differential diagnosis.
So there's a little July taste of what we have going on in AZMcast. Hopefully you guys enjoyed it. Hopefully you get some stuff out of it. We put this out once a month, and we hope that you can give us some feedback, give us some ideas of stuff that you like so that we can make it interesting for you. Next month, we're going to run another case. We're going to have Rich Amini on. We're going to start a new evidence-based medicine series, because if there's one thing that I absolutely am clueless about, it's statistics. And if there's one thing that Rich knows really, really well, it's Borat. If there's a second thing he knows really, really well, it's evidence-based medicine. So he's going to be helping out a lot on the podcast, and I think that'll be fantastic. So until then, good luck to everybody in July. Good luck to our new interns. Feel free to ask anybody you need to for help. Your nurses are your friends. Your upper levels are your friends. For your juniors and seniors, you guys are doing fantastic, keeping everybody going, keeping the department running, and helping the interns along. So thank you, everybody. It's a pleasure to work with you all, and we will see you next month.